In the 2004 election, the Democrats and the Kerry campaign raised as much or more money than the Bush GOP did. And for the first time in years, nearly all progressive factions came together to beat Bush. And still they failed. Now, we've talked several times on the show about the lessons to be learned from that failure, from this, you know, this expert, that expert, people who think that that progressive coalition can stay together, people who think it can't, and so on. And today, I'm going to be joined by the authors of a new book called Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. Jerome Armstrong and Marcos Moulitsas Zuniga are the founders of MyDD and Daily Cause, two of the most influential political blogs in America, with web traffic numbers that compete with the circulation of major daily newspapers. And they've written this book together, and I find the book smart and pragmatic as hell. And they join me in the studio. We're going to look at that. Jerome Armstrong, a pioneer of the blogosphere, founded one of the first political blogs, MyDD.com, in 2001. He's the person behind the Netroot strategy that used blogs and meetups for Howard Dean's campaign, and he works as an internet strategist for advocacy organizations and political campaigns in the D.C. area. Marcos Moulitsas Zuniga served in the U.S. Army for 3 years, later earned two bachelor's degrees from Northern Illinois University and a law degree from Boston University. After moving to California to work in the tech industry, Marcos started DailyCause.com in May 2002. His blog has had a meteoric rise, now gets more than 1 million unique visitors each day, making it one of the most popular blogs in the nation. Welcome, Jerome and Marcos. Now, I like listeners to get to know the people behind the work and the ideas, so I'm going to ask you each a question that might not be about the book. Mm-hmm. In your case, Jerome, you started that in 2001. Mm-hmm. What was your path to starting a political blog? Because 5 years ago, that was not on everybody's to-do list.
Yeah, and in fact, when I started, it wasn't even really a blog. It was just posting something out there that was an article of relating to what I thought was the direction of the country was going the wrong direction with Bush. And what I quickly realized, though, that there were a lot of people out there that felt the same way. And from the comments and feedback that I was getting back from people that were out there.
Okay.
One of the first early ones with Marcos.
I was one of those early people.
Yeah. Oh, you just happened to see, commented in.
Absolutely.
And it was months later that you started Daily Cause.
More than months. I mean, it might have been actually a year later.
A year?
Yeah.
Now, you, I think one of the interesting things I find in your bio is your time in the Army. Now, how did you get into our all-volunteer Army, and what did you get out of it?
I have a piece on this in the current issue of the American Prospect, and people don't realize this, but the military is actually one of the most egalitarian kind of ideal societies you'll find anywhere. It is incredibly colorblind. I had my food paid for. I had my housing paid for, free medical care and dental care. The pay disparity between the lowliest private and the highest-ranking general isn't anywhere near what you see in the private sector. It is very much an egalitarian society, and we all looked out for each other. We took care of each other. There was this notion, very, very radical, I guess, in modern-day America, but that we were only as strong as our weakest link. And so I went in, actually, as a Republican, and I came out a Democrat. And people had this perception of the military being this bastion of conservatism. And the officer corps, in a lot of ways, is because they want their big, expensive presence, and you know, the Republicans will give them their B-1 bombers and et cetera, et cetera. But the rank and file, the enlisted personnel, they're actually, they come from all walks of life, from all corners of the country. Most of them are not people of wealthy means, of good means. They're natural Democrats, and if anything, they're more politically apathetic. We're seeing now with Iraq that's changing. But to me, it's not a surprise that when you look at so many people coming out of the veterans ranks running for office that they're choosing to run as Democrats, because that is, in lots of ways, the ideal society.
Wow. I mean, this, again, tell me why you went in.
I went in because at the time I was, even now, I'm not necessarily anti-military action. I very much believe that there is a time and place. I grew up in war-torn El Salvador, and I saw that the incredible role that the United Nations peacekeeping forces had in bringing peace to that country. So I had first-hand experience with the ravages of war, and firsthand experiences with how military force could be used for good. So I was never anti-military, but I always thought, at the time in high school, I wanted to be a politician, and thank God that got burned out of me. But at the time, I thought I wanted to be a politician, and I thought, you know, if I'm ever in a position to send our men and women in uniform into combat, that I can't do so in good conscience unless I had been there myself, which, again, is a very radical notion given who's in power today. The notion of self-sacrifice and service to the nation does not exist in D.C. and in the Republican ranks. But for me, that was important, and that's why I joined.
Wow. Thank you very much. So that was Marcos Mulitzas Zuniga, and I'm speaking with he and Jerome Armstrong. They're the authors of Crashing the Gate, and they each run political blogs, MyDD.com and DailyCause.com. Having said that, whichever one of you wants to take it, again, just a little bit about the process of you guys working together. A blog is a participatory thing. It's off the top of your head. Then you sit down and you're writing a book that's going to, people are going to hold in their hands. It's going to stand up and they're going to say, this is what they really think. What were the challenges of writing a book, both the length, the finality of it, and the fact that it's the two of you doing it together, whereas a blog really is you're on your own.
Right. Well, we'd worked together on a lot of projects before we took the blog up. So we were used to working together. That wasn't a difficulty there. What we did differently from blogging, though, is we actually went out and did some, you know, journalistic reporting. We went to 20 different states, interviewed over 160 people. So the blog, or the book, is really a compilation of all of these different interviews that we did in the states. And really getting to the root of the problem, which you addressed starting this show, is how did the Democrats lose in 2004, given that the polls showed that people agreed with where we stood on the issues, they agreed that the direction of the country was wrong, and yet we didn't win.
Yeah,
it was you know, it was tough. Is that with blogging, you spend a couple of minutes working on a blog post, and then you're done, and then there's a finality to it, and you can move on to other things. And so it was tough working on a book that where we had to, you know, literally write out the entire arguments, you know, thousands of words with the arguments. When you blog, you just add a link, right, to somebody who has already made that argument or to a previous post that makes that argument. So it was very, very much a brutal process. I don't think we expected it to be as tough as it was, given how much we actually write. But, you know, what was great about it is that it was a work of journalism. I think that's why it has been so well received in it by reviewers everywhere. I mean, it's gotten great review after great review. And given who we were, you know, and are in bloggers, right, we don't have that credibility in a lot of ways as some of these established pundits and consultants. It was surprising how well received it was. And it was because it wasn't just two bloggers sitting around thinking, well, what do we think are the solutions? We looked around the country. We said, okay, states like Colorado and Minnesota and Montana have been great success stories. Mm-hmm. We're going to go out and find out why they're winning in Colorado and see if we can take some of those solutions and apply them to the national party.
But we also went to Texas and found out what went wrong down
yeah,
there in
I
Texas.
Know. I know. How did Texas go from one to the other? And as you point out, it wasn't just the South. It was, in other words, we know that happened in the South, but Texas was lagging behind the rest of the South in terms of going Republican.
But
it was a very concerted effort.
And then what they've done is take that Texas model and try to adopt it nationally now. You call Rove and all those people trying to put that strategy in place nationally.
As you mentioned, one of the things that Rove did early on was kind of under the radar when they got judges elected,
mm-hmm.
because judges could then set the legal tone for business, and suddenly a businessman sees where his bread's buttered and switches parties.
Right.
Yeah,
and now we see, of course, with the, I mean, Alito and Roberts, whatever else you say, they are imperial presidential folks. I mean, they believe in the executive really strong, and they're very corporate.
Well, yeah, the Republicans and Karl Rove, they're master chess players. I mean, they're not looking ahead to the next election cycle. They're looking ahead 10, 20 years and the moves that are going to keep them in that majority in 10, 20 years. And that's why they'll do things. Instead of focusing in Texas on those legislative races, they focus on the judicial races. I mean, nobody else has ever come up with a strategy like that. It was brutally effective, and it allowed them to set the tone for this current Republican regime. So We really suffer from very short term thinking.
We being the
progressive movement, the Democratic Party, and it's killing us. And they don't do that, which is why they're so successful.
Yeah, it's interesting actually because one would think that a progressive actually has a longer-term view of the issues, but not of the tactics, right? In other words,
but our issue groups, though, they're each concerned about only their issue, not the movement.
You point out one of the things I think is really stuck out for me is how many people sacrificed to make all those small donations that went into the Democrats finally equaling the Republicans in fundraising, and all the people who volunteered. I have friends, we all have friends, who got in their cars and drove to some swing state for nothing. And then you point out how much money went into the pockets of the consultants. Talk about some of that.
Yes, and you know, the really sad thing is...
This is Jerome. Yeah.
It's not changing. That particular part of the equation, as we go into the 2006 election, is not changing. We still have the same structure in place, which is going to reward these media consultants with all of the hard-earned money that we donate into the party.
And millions of dollars. Yeah. So they're taking 15% of every media buy.
Yeah, explain that. And this is something which used to be in all of advertising, but now most corporate advertising has left it. But
and the Republicans, you know, most of them have left it as well.
This is going to blow people's minds.
Yeah, it used to be that a media firm, when placing ads, say they place $1 million in ads, they would take a 15% commission on every dollar spent. So they'd come out of it with $150,000. Just for placing, just for making a few phone calls to a couple of television stations and radio stations and say, hey, when can you place the ad? We want to show it so many times. Business realized really early on that, one, that was a stupid waste of money because it wasn't that hard to place ads. And two, they realized that it incentivized the wrong kind of behavior. These consultants weren't interested in placing the best kind of ads in the best locations. They were interested in placing as much as possible because that's how they made their money. So now you have Republicans who in the Bush campaign, they spent the campaign itself, not the allied organizations, but the Bush campaign spent about 50% more on advertising than the Kerry campaign. Yet they paid half as much in media fees as Kerry. Bush campaign spent $6 million on media placement. The Kerry campaign spent $11 to $12 million. That we know. There's a lot of shell companies and shenanigans, so we can't quite know the exact number. But it's around $11 to $12 million in media placement. So we placed less ads and paid twice as much in media placement. And this is $6 million. $6 million to Bob Schrum and other consultants in D.C. that came out of people's hard-earned dollars. So everybody who gave $50 to Kerry or $100 or $10, their hard-earned money, it went into the pocket of these consultants who just wasted it, knowing that there's a better way, knowing that there's a bigger cause at stake than their pocketbooks. They didn't care. They don't care.
Okay. Were you going to say something, Jerome?
Well, the other part of this equation is, how do they stay in power given that? And it is a whole network that we have there of rotating chairs. They'll go to work for the state party one cycle. Next cycle, they'll go into a campaign and work it. Next cycle, they'll go work a presidential race. And they literally have a lock on the system.
And one of the things that you point out is the role of the Democratic senatorial campaign, congressional campaign committees, mm-hmm. that they actually steer you to their consultants.
Yeah, because they'll put those consultants onto the campaign, and they're sort of, they will be the inside source for those party organizations to decide to where to put the money in. So their loyalty, those consultants that are working on those campaigns, their loyalty is not to the candidate. It's to the party organizations in D.C., and they're more interested in maintaining that relationship than they are in the candidate winning, because that's where they're going to get the jobs next time.
Yeah, and here's from a this is what really hurts in a lot of ways. If we were winning, if they were effective, we could maybe look the other way and say we're winning. It's effective, right? But they'll do things like what happened in Missouri in 2004. We had a candidate named Nancy Farmer who was running for Senate. She was elected in 2000 statewide as state treasurer in Missouri on a platform of universal health care, with a team of local consultants who knew the local scene, right? So she runs for Senate, and the party comes in. They say, if you're going to take our millions of dollars, you're going to have to use our consultants. The D.C. consultants literally push everybody, all her local people, out of the campaign. And then they tell her things like, you cannot talk about universal health care because that's a killer for us. It hurts us politically. She had won precisely campaigning on that issue in 2000 with people who knew the local scene, but D.C. knew better. D.C. always knows better than the people in Missouri, the people in Montana, the people in Florida, and so on. And in a lot of ways, that's killing us.
Of course, we believe just the opposite.
Grassroots knows better.
Yeah.
The locals.
Across the nation.
Always, the locals.
Now, why did she cave? The motivation, the carrot in that you're going to get money.
Yeah.
If you want party funds, you have to do the party consultants and the party line.
Yep. That's exactly right.
So I mean, one of the things we argue that's really important is that, yeah, we all hate the fact that politics is so driven by money. But the issue isn't really the money in a lot of ways. It's who owns these politicians, who owns these consultants. And now with this new people-powered movement and internet fundraising and grassroots fundraising, we can actually buy these candidates so they're not beholden to D.C. So, you know, when Dean was elected DNC chairman, a bunch of fundraisers quit because Dean wasn't given the big donors FaceTime. And we know what FaceTime is, right? When we send our $20 to Howard Dean or to our favorite candidates, we're not demanding FaceTime. We're demanding that they be good progressives, and that's it. We don't want legislation, special favors. We don't want them to, you know, fancy picture with a candidate. We just want them to be good progressives. And I think candidates love that because they do want to get away from FaceTime. It's ugly. It's corrupting. It's cynical.
It wastes time.
Absolutely.
Now, let me ask you, what's your take on I'm not right in the middle of it all, but it struck me that what Dean seemed to be doing was energizing the grassroots and energizing state organizations. What's your take? You said it isn't changing. Is anything changing?
Well, that is changing, that part, because what we're doing is putting money back into the organizations, the Democratic organizations, in many of these states that are red states that have been ignored for decades.
That's another thing you point out is that the Republicans, we always hear the Republicans play to their base, mm-hmm. but in fact what you say is that they use the new technology to actually reach out not just to their base, mm-hmm. but to their less loyal folks, and to go into Democratic precincts and Democratic areas. And the Democrats only go where they think their bases or where they're strong.
It's 75. If there's 75% Democrats or more, that's where they are. Everybody else
they just ignore. So when you had a failing war and lots of incompetence and stuff, if there were Republican areas that people might have been on the fence, we didn't even try to move them.
Well, Ohio is a great example. 35 counties in Ohio, there was no Democratic presence at all. You know how much money we dumped in Ohio as a party in 2004? Hundreds of millions. You know, and counting our 527 organizations, Act Blue dumped in, you know, 30 million alone into Ohio.
But, and ignored 35 out of
88.
So nearly half. Close to half of the state.
These are
rural.
Granted,
they weren't the population
centers. They're not the population centers, but still, there's Democratic voters out there.
Yeah.
You know,
people that just might have been, because there was already corruption. There were already whiffs of corruption in the Republicans in Ohio.
Yeah, absolutely.
We would have won it if we would have done, you know.
If we'd have gone for the whole state.
You know,
now, when Dean says, by the way, we're going for folks who have guns, gun racks in their trucks and stuff, and he got blasted for that, for the remark, but is the DNC under Dean going more for the whole country?
Yeah, they're actually, two ways. One is that they're actually spending Democratic National Committee money on hiring staff. So each state has between 3 and 5 staffers that are directly paid for by the DNC. So you have states that never even had a full-time Democratic Party presence now actually have full-time people as spokespeople and organizers. And that's one way. Second way he's doing it is he's going to the states. He's raising money. And traditionally, money raised by Democratic Party was shipped back to D.C. so the consultants could spend it, right? Now Dean is saying, keep it. Which is really radical. And every time you see one of these articles in the papers blasting Dean for not
raising enough money, not being Terry McAuliffe.
Right. Yeah, yeah. It's these consultants.
It's an unnamed consultant.
Unnamed source.
It's money directly out of their pocket. And what's amazing about this is that Dean has still shattered all DNC records for fundraising, even though he's keep letting states keep that money that he raises.
That isn't what those articles seem to say, is it?
Absolutely not.
No, we get called by those same reporters every couple months. They're trying to grind out that story.
And you give them
we push
other
back.
Side.
Yeah.
They probably don't print it.
No, then they don't print it.
Okay, let me tell you. You're listening.
Which is a victory in its own right. I mean, we got to take our small victories where we can get them right now.
You mean it's a victory that they don't print it?
Right, exactly.
Let me say one thing. I just want to. This is a personal thing. You mention Rob. You cite Rob Stein as the guy whose PowerPoint has shined a light on the vast right wing conspiracy, the think tanks, the money raising, and so on. I interviewed Sally Covington of the Center for Responsive Philanthropy, who made all those points in 98. Mm-hmm. Is Rob Stein's work basically building on hers?
It's building on a lot of people's work. I mean, People for the American Way actually has probably more of that data came from People for the American Way. What Rob Stein did was very effective about it is he was good at marketing it. Right. And we have a problem as a party and as a movement marketing, obviously. I mean, we don't have the machinery that they do in marketing their message. And what Rob Stein did, basically, is finally pushed that. A lot of people were doing this sort of work. He finally pushed it into the consciousness of the big money.
He could get them to meet in a room and look at his PowerPoint.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it wasn't all his original research, obviously.
I think Simon Rosenberg helped him quite a bit on that end
as
well.
Who runs the New Democrat Network and the New Politics Institute. One of the few people in D.C. actually that is forward-thinking, whose heart, I think, is in Silicon Valley. And so he thinks from an entrepreneurial standpoint. And
Andy Stern in the labor movement, I think, somewhat similarly.
Absolutely.
Just thinks the box is global for him, the box he's outside of.
Yeah, I mean, D.C. really is a bubble. I mean, it sounds so cliche to talk about the Beltway, and I always thought that was kind of cliche talk. And then you spend a little bit of time there, and you go to the cocktail party circuits, and you see the circular arguments that are happening where people are reinforcing each other's biases and thoughts on issues that have no bearing on reality. And it's good to see that there are still a few people in D.C. that recognize that the world doesn't work the way they think they do. But what's important, I think, about the Netroots and a lot of the grassroots groups that are emerging is that we derive our strength from people outside of D.C. and we're forcing D.C. to pay attention. And that has never happened before, at least not in the last few decades.
Now, when you say it hasn't changed yet, in other words, that the consultants with the control still have the control, what can listeners do? In other words, what I'm always afraid listeners do is they hear a conversation like this and they go, see, that's it. I'm going green, or I'm going single issue, or I'm going independent, or I'm dropping out completely. What can you guys really, I can see your goal, your vision is that's too small. That we have to find a way to make the progressive side dominate again, because America basically agrees with our issues.
Yeah. I think what we have to do is awareness is a big thing here. You know, a lot of people didn't know that whole commission racket existed. So getting the awareness out there is one thing, but, you know, we have a quote at the beginning of the book from Gandhi, and the first thing is, first they ignore you. And really, that's what the consultants are doing now. They're just kind of ignoring us. We haven't gotten any pushback at all from the consultants in D.C. over the whole book. So, but the way to exert pressure is by going to the candidates themselves and telling them, hey, are you using this? Is this the way that you're running this campaign? And this is where we were last night meeting a bunch of heavy Democratic funders and making that point to them, that tell the candidates themselves to change the way they're doing the campaigns.
Yeah, and a lot of it is I still counsel that we don't put any money into the party committees until they've proven that they can reform. I mean, Charles Schumer runs the Senate effort for the Democrats, and he was bragging just recently about how if anybody's going to take his money, that they're going to have his people running those campaigns, which is exactly what we said is the wrong thing. And he was proud of this. So don't put money into the party committees until they show that they're different. But there's a lot of really inspiring candidates out there. And find those candidates that speak to you and put that $20. I mean, we're not saying, it takes a lot of money, but enough people give those few dollars makes a huge difference.
One of the sites that we advocate is actblue.com. And you can find Democratic candidates that are very progressive and back them.
Any other sites? And then what I want you to do, we've got about 2-3 minutes. I want you to talk about what happened in Colorado and Montana. But first, if there are any other sites where people can learn, any other books, any other things you think people should be paying attention to?
I think it's I want people to look locally. So find the local bloggers, and because those are the people who are really going to affect you directly the most are your local council members and your local county commissioners and your local municipal elected officials and congressmen. So think locally and build that bench.
And think long term.
Yeah, obviously.
Now, tell us, Jerome, you tell us about Colorado, and then Marcos, you tell us about Montana, because they use two very different models to succeed in what were at best purple states.
Right. In Colorado, what the Democrats did was they were able to get some strong financial funding, and that came with a string attached. And the string was that the groups would work together.
I want to go back, because I was in Colorado last week, and people told me about it, and then I picked up your book and read the same thing, that basically four rich, young progressives said, you know, if we decide to change this state, we can do it, and they proved it can be done. So it wasn't just that it was like these four guys said, we're going to have money for you, but only if all these single-issue groups will work together.
Right. They literally called them into the, you know, they called them up and they said, come to the room. We're going to work together. You know, if you show up, then you'll. They had to show up. They wanted to get the money. They had no choice, really, if they wanted to survive as an organization. So once they got there, they laid out the strategy. Here's how we're going to do it. And so they went out, and the other strategy that worked tremendously well was that the party went out and recruited candidates everywhere. They didn't just select a number of seats to take it over by mere majority. They selected 16 seats in the House that they would want to go after.
And they won 15 out of 16.
And most of these were in conservative districts.
Yeah. So it was unbelievable.
And then what they did with the issue groups is, one, that they forced them to essentially back candidates that maybe didn't meet their litmus test. You know?
In other words, if you were a good progressive, but you weren't quite right on gun control, you weren't quite right on
choice, the environment,
choice,
labor,
that was okay because as you say, if the Democrats control Congress, the non-democratic issues aren't going to get – you're not going to have a Roe v. Wade.
But they're not listening. Yeah. Republicans don't listen to us anymore.
Right.
So that was critical. And then by working together, they didn't duplicate efforts. We always hear about Ohio, how 10 people would knock on the same door, and finally the guy in the House would be like, you know, I hate you guys, leave me alone. And it would be counterproductive and a waste of energy and resources and time. So
what did Montana do? They did a different thing.
Yeah, Montana was different. I mean, this is a very conservative state. Colorado's, you know, on the bubble. Montana, very conservative. Bush won 59-39. So what they had to do, basically, the Democrats told the issue groups that, you know what, we're going to set our own message. You guys can't tell us what we are about. We're going to tell the people of Montana what Democrats stand for, and we're going to do the sale. And you guys can sit in the sidelines and watch. And if you want to help, great. If not, you know, we don't care.
Okay, so one said, we'll give you money if you work together. The other one said, we don't even need you. We're going to do it. Work with us if you want.
Exactly.
So these are crashing the gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the rise of people-powered politics has some radical notions about strategies and tactics. It's a real how-to kind of how, what can we learn and how do we go forward. The websites where you can learn more are crashingthegate.com and chelseagreen.com. Their two blogs are Jerome Armstrong's is mydd.com and Marcos's is dailycause.com. Thank you, Jerome Armstrong, Marcos Mulitzis Zuniga. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Terry.